Macroeconomics was presented by Chris Swanson on August 13, 2009 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. PDF notes accompany this talk.
Okay, I'm going to be talking about macroeconomics, hopefully. I am no economist, and so what I have to say is primarily just a number of different aspects about macroeconomics, various things that might be interesting to us, and hopefully there will be something in here that will be helpful to you. So I've split it up into sort of six different areas. So can you turn on my slide here? So I'm going to talk about supply and demand first, and I'm going to talk about output and wealth, how one measures wealth of a country through output. I'm going to be talking about money, how money works in a society. I'm going to be talking a little bit about expectations and the importance of expectations in the working of a modern economy. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about crashes, how we get the boom and bust cycle, and some of the features of such a cycle. And then lastly, I talk a little bit about government intervention, how the government uses the tools that it has at its disposal to manipulate the economy. So that's sort of the general areas that I thought might be helpful to talk about. I'm going to go to the next one. So first we're going to talk about supply and demand. So I've got a little bit of a graph here. Some of you probably have seen this before. Maybe you've taken an economics class, and there might be a lot of stuff that a lot of people here have seen, but hopefully there'll be something helpful. So the bottom part of the graph is going to be quantity. We're talking about a good or service that is produced in society. It might be, I don't know, iron or cars or something like that. And right here on this axis, we're talking about the quantity of that particular product which is produced. And this graph is going to be the price. And as you go up higher on that side of the axis, then the price goes up. And as you go out this way, the quantity goes up. So I've got two different plots on there. One of them is the demand plot, and the other one is the supply. The basic idea is fairly simple. If you were to, say, raise the price of a particular quantity, the higher the price goes, the lower the demand goes, because people don't want to spend more money. If you raise the price of your cars, people are going to buy fewer, so there's not going to be as big of a demand. So as the price goes up, the quantity that people are going to want is going to go down, and that's that red curve. So follow the red curve. If the price is down here, you're going to want a lot of quantity. As the price goes up to here, the quantity that people are going to demand is going to be lower. And it's just the opposite for supply. Presumably, if the price is very high, then the people who are producing it are going to make lots of them. As the price drops, some of the companies that were making cars, for instance, can no longer supply cars at that lower price, and they go out of business or something like that. Or they cut back on their production because they're not making very much money. So as the price drops, their quantity that they're going to produce is also going to go down. All right? And this sort of gives you also an important picture with regard to price controls. We've talked a little bit about price controls and how government might set a price control. If the government sets the price control at the wrong spot, say they set the price control at this point way up there, P asterisk or something like that, then what will happen is that the demand, okay, for that particular quantity will be quite low. And the people who are producing are saying, wow, look, I can get all this money for this thing that I produce, so I'm going to make a lot of them. And they will produce a whole lot of them, and then you'll get a glut, because the quantity that is produced is this amount, and the amount that people are buying is this amount, and the difference between those two amounts is going to be the overproduction, and you're going to get an oversupply. And similarly, I haven't drawn it, but if you fix the price too low, then what will happen is people will want more than is available. Okay, so if you fix the prices, a lot of times what you'll get is real severe shortages. Okay, but presumably there's some happy medium, some point where those two lines cross, and that's where the price will sort of automatically equilibrate. So the whole idea of the classical economy or the market economy is that there's going to be some stable price where supply and demand are crossing. Okay, so next one. So the situation can change. People can change their buying habits, okay? Maybe for some particular product, people are more interested in that product. Whereas in the past, they hadn't been interested in the product, now they're more interested in that product. You could have a changing demographic or something like that, or an aging population or something like that. Or you could be changing your cultural values. Things which seemed like they were really cool before are no longer cool anymore. So you may change your demand for some particular product. You could have an increased wealth in society. All sorts of things can create change in demand. Expectations also can change demand. If everybody suddenly thinks that the economy is going to boom and their job is secure and they're going to be getting a raise next year, then maybe people will want more goods. They have more money on their hands, or they expect to have more money, so the demand will go up. And what happens generally when the demand goes up, the whole curve shifts to the right. Okay? So whereas before we had a situation on this red curve and the equilibrium price was at this P1 and the quantity that was produced was Q1, if the demand shifts and everybody wants more, then what's going to happen is the producers are going to produce more and they're going to produce it at a higher price. Okay? And they're going to get a higher price for it. This will be the new position for the equilibrium, presumably. So if the demand goes up, that's really good for the producers because they're going to sell more at higher prices, and it's going to be really good for them. The only loser there, I guess, would be the people who are actually buying it because now the prices have all gone up. Okay, can we move on to the next one? Other things that can happen is you can shift the supply of available goods of some particular good. So if you have, for instance, an increase in efficiency, that can happen in a variety of ways. You can have better technology, you can have better organization, you can have better way to use division of labor, for instance. That was an increase in efficiency with which you could produce something. All those sorts of things, better management, something like that, can improve your supply. So basically what's happening is that you can produce the same product for a lower price. And so if you can produce the same product for a lower price, okay, you've improved your efficiency or something like that, then if the price was before at P1, at that price now you're willing to produce this many. But what will generally happen is it was producing this price, this quantity, and what will happen now is the price will go down a little bit and you will be producing more. That's okay if the price goes down if you're a producer because you're able to make them at a cheaper price in the first place. So the winner in that situation is the consumer because all the prices go down. So you've seen things happen like that with computer technology. The prices keep going down. The value of the computer keeps going up or the ability of the computer keeps going up, those sorts of things like that. And I just want to make a comment that presumably, this sort of thing works with all kinds of commodities, and a modern economists consider, for instance, money, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, as one of the commodities that this applies to. So if you have a large supply of money, okay, then the price of that money to use it, which is the interest rate, is going to go down. And if you have a short supply of money, then the price of that is also going to go up, so the interest rate will go up. So we'll see how that's going to work out a little bit later. All right, the next slide. So a few caveats about this sort of supply and demand situation, okay? Reality is really actually very complex. So this is like a perfect model or a model that doesn't necessarily always apply. This is sort of the textbook model, the supply and demand model that I've given you. It sort of works. It sort of gives you a framework for thinking about these things, but it doesn't always work, as far as I can tell. Prices are going to fluctuate around this equilibrium price. They can be held too high or too low, and things can just shift all over the place, and it's really hard to tell exactly where those lines ought to be or where they're going to be or how they're going to shift and all those sorts of things like that. So obviously, price regulations and fixing of prices was going to affect that sort of situation. You can have world events that will affect both supply and demand. temporarily. Expectations can temporarily affect supply and demand. If there's, for instance, if there's a fear of a recession, everybody starts thinking, oh, the economy is going down. I may lose my job. I'm not going to take that vacation that I was thinking of taking. I'm not going to buy that vehicle that I was thinking of buying. I'm going to save my money. Okay? And that can have a big impact on the demand, because if people are all saving their money and not spending anymore, then the demand for goods in general is going to go down. So those sorts of things can happen. And of course, the government can try and stimulate supply and demand. They can do that in a variety of ways. Like, I've come up with this one example of the Cash for Clunkers program. I don't know exactly how this is going to work, but it seems to me, and this is just my observation, is that if you produce some sort of, if you stimulate the demand for cars by offering cash for clunkers, then a lot of people are going to buy more cars, and more people are buying cars now. But it seems to me that in about 2 or 3 years, when all those clunkers were going to be replaced anyway, people aren't going to be replacing those cars that they would have replaced 2 or 3 years ago. So it's sort of stealing future demand in order to stimulate present demand. So it's not necessarily always going to end up to be the best situation, or it's in the long term, that kind of situation. Maybe that will work out and it will be beneficial in the long run. But we might see a drain of demand in buying new cars in a couple years. I don't know. Tim, you want to? All right, so the next one I want to talk about is output. So I have a little silly picture of a factory. So the way economists talk about measuring a country's wealth is by looking at the total amount of goods and services which are produced, not so much the total amount of cash on hand. You could have a country which has lots and lots of cash, they've printed lots and lots of money, but they're not producing a lot of goods. And just because they have lots and lots of money, but they're not producing a lot of goods, then they tend to get inflation. And so really, the best way to measure, most economists believe, is by measuring how much is actually being produced. And that was what Adam Smith's position was, is it wasn't the amount of gold in the King's Bank vault. It was more how much was being produced by the country. So how do people measure that? Because it seems like that would be a complicated kind of thing to measure. There's a couple of different ways. The term that they use for it is GDP, gross domestic product. You probably heard that term being thrown around in the news, and probably most of you all know basically what it is, but the way they usually measure it is by measuring the total amount of final expenditures. Okay? What's not a final expenditure? If a car company buys steering wheels from a supplier, that's not counted in the GDP. The steering wheel manufacturer buys plastic from a plastic manufacturer, that's not counted in the GDP. And the plastic manufacturer buying raw oil or whatever, crude or something like that, from the oil company to make their plastics, that's not considered as part of the GDP either. And the reason why is because the price of the oil is incorporated in the price of the plastic, and the price of the plastic is incorporated in the price of the steering wheel, and the price of the steering wheel is incorporated in the price of the car. So if you were to count all those things in the GDP, then you would be counting the price of that crude oil that created the plastic in the steering wheel like 3 or 4 times, right? So all you really want to do is you want to count it once, and that's by counting final expenditures. So that's the way they do it. And I can't even imagine being the kind of person that could go around and try and count all those things up, but there are people that do that. So the way they count it is they put it into a variety of categories. There is the private consumption category, okay? So that is all goods and services that we buy for ourselves and consume. So TVs, food, cars, those sorts of things, those are all private consumption. Then there is investment, okay? If a business or the government buys a factory or buys a piece of machinery or buys a computer or something like that, these things are not going to be resold. They are not supplies that are going into some other final product. It is stuff that is being purchased for the purpose of being able to produce something else. So they call that investment. And that's counted up in the GDP. And then there's government spending, which is basically the same as private spending, except the government's doing it. And then you have to add exports and subtract imports. The reason why you add and subtract exports and imports is because, let's suppose the government is, or the country is producing a lot of goods, and we're exporting those goods out of the country, and then they're being bought by, I don't know, England or France or something like that, then those purchases over in England and France are not being counted as final expenditures in our GDP, but at the same time, we did make them. Yeah?
Real quick, is that the balance of trade formula?
Yes. That's the balance. I'll talk about that in just a second. So then the imports is just the opposite. If somebody else is manufacturing something, and those manufactured goods, a bunch of Japanese stereos comes over to the United States, and we buy them, those purchases are going to be counted in the private consumption area, but the United States didn't produce them. So we shouldn't count that as a measure of the amount of stuff that we produced. So that's not counted in, it's subtracted off the GDP. So if the exports are greater than the imports, then you have a trade, I don't even know what they call it. Let's say the imports are greater than the exports, then you have a trade deficit. We've all heard of that, right? Because that's where we've been running, is in trade deficit for many, many years, all right? So yeah, you add the exports, subtract the imports. So that's how you count it. You can also try and add it up by measuring income, because presumably all the stuff that we spend, we've made. So hopefully, if you do a proper accounting of income, you could also add up the GDP, but that's less typical. All right, so Tim, you want to go? So here's a pretty picture that shows you the GDP. In 2008, the total GDP in the United States was $14.4 trillion, big chunk of cash. And that sort of gives you a feel for how that was divvied up. This little section, this little pie section over here, the total amount of personal consumption starts here and goes all the way around to there, not to here. And then you subtract this part off because that was the trade deficit. The imports were greater than the exports. So that's how that works. All right, debt. There are two kinds of debt, as far as I can tell. Maybe there's a billion kinds of debt, but I'm only going to talk about two kinds of debt. I'm going to talk about the first kind of debt is the debt that the country as a whole acquires for itself. This is not the debt that the government acquires for itself, but the country as a whole. Okay? So how do you get debt? You get debt if your exports are less than your imports. Why is that? That means that you are spending more money than you are actually producing, right? Because you're importing more goods than you're exporting. Somebody else is producing a bunch of goods. They are importing it into the United States. We are spending that money, but we are not making that enough money to pay for that because we are not producing that much. So if we're importing more than we're exporting, we're spending more than we're producing. So how are we going to spend more than we produce? We've got to borrow money. And we cannot borrow money internally from banks which are holding savings accounts of people who are in the United States. Because basically, if you're borrowing it internally, then you're just one person is spending less by putting it in the bank so that somebody else can spend more. So you're not actually providing any more money for the government or for the country as a whole to spend. So the only way that you can go into debt is by creating foreign debt, by borrowing from people in other countries. And how do you borrow from people in other countries? They are producing more than they are spending. So if they're producing more than they're spending, then they are saving money. We can borrow that money that they're saving, and we can spend more than we're producing. Okay? If you get into that situation, then you are running a trade deficit. For 2008, the trade deficit was about 4.9% of GDP, which doesn't sound like much. But you have to count up all the trade deficits that we've been building up over a number of years, and apparently current total debt that the country is holding is around 20%. Okay. So it could be that by running a trade deficit, that's not a bad thing, because what you're doing is taking all the extra money that you're spending instead of producing, and you're investing it into your businesses. And hopefully, if you invest it into your businesses, they're going to have the potential for being able to produce more to raise your GDP. And if the GDP goes up, then you'll have plenty of cash in order to pay off that debt. If, on the other hand, all that money that you are spending that you're not producing is going into consumption, then later on we will have to tighten our belt and produce more than we are spending. Okay, so the second kind of debt is the national debt, which gets a lot more publicity, okay? And this is the debt that's held by the government in particular, okay? Now, this debt can be financed internally because it's the government is borrowing. The government can borrow from the citizens. It can borrow from various people. This is not, what I'm talking about here is not money that is printed by the Federal Reserve or something like that. It's not new money that's created. It's money that is borrowed, as far as I can tell, from foreign countries or from internal people who are saving money here, okay? And you can, it's kind of interesting to look at how the national debt has gone over the last few years. Obviously, in the wartime in the 1940s, the debt ballooned because the government was spending way more money than it was taking in order to finance the war. And all through the years, through Carter, after that, apparently the national debt was going down. And then Bush and Reagan had this great idea that we were going to push up the national debt, and they spent a lot more money. They went into deficit spending, and it went down again. And then this last little jump right here, the horizontal line presumably is where Obama took over, and this little jump is Bush's spending right at the end of his time for all those TARP and various things that he spent money on. And obviously, this is a little bit outdated. I think it's probably a little higher now. I don't know. Okay, problem with debt can come about if the debt gets too big. I know David mentioned this earlier, or somebody else mentioned it earlier. I'm not exactly sure how this works. When is a debt too big of a debt? But I know that one of the things that can happen is the way we finance our debt is that we sell government bonds. So how does the government bond work? It's pretty simple. The government takes this piece of paper and he says, here's a bond for $100. I'll give you this bond and you give me $100. Seems like a pretty sweet deal, right? All I have to do is give you a piece of paper and they give you $100. But the promise is that in the future, some number of years down the line, depends on how many year bond it is, I'm going to pay back that $100 with some interest. And so the bond will have some associated interest rate with it. Okay? So people will buy government bonds. The government gets a whole bunch of cash that they can spend, and they owe these people who have bought their bonds, maybe Chinese people, maybe hold a bunch of our bonds or something like that. The problem happens if the Chinese people or anybody in the world starts thinking, I'm a little concerned that those bonds that I'm holding of the United States are not going to be worth as much. There could be a couple reasons for that. They could believe that the United States isn't going to be able to pay off those bonds, or they may be concerned that the inflation in the United States is going way up. If the inflation is going up much faster than the interest rate on their bond, then the buying power of the $100 that they gave to the government initially is not going to be the same buying power when they are ready to cash in on their bond. Maybe they've gotten a little bit of interest from that, but if the inflation is really high, then the bond that they're going to get, they're going to get $150 when that bond matures, but that $150 is going to buy less goods than the $100 did way back when. So if inflation is a really big deal, people are going to want to try and dump their bonds. And it's going to be really hard for the government. It's going to have to offer a higher interest rate on their bonds in order to sell them again. And as the interest rate that the United States has to put out on their bonds goes up, then it's harder for them to borrow money, and it becomes more expensive for them to borrow money, and the United States gets in all kinds of trouble. So the trouble comes if they have too much debt, or people are afraid of the government being able to pay off those bonds, or if inflation starts going up. And I think those are some issues that need to be at least considered. But I'm no economist, so I don't know how big that debt can be. All right. So money. Go ahead. Next one. The way people talk about money is they talk about it in terms of a money supply, and money supply is primarily considering liquid money supply, so it would be currency that's floating around, and demand deposits. Demand deposits are things like checking accounts. Not so much long-term accounts that can't be sold off right away. So if you have something in a money market or something like that, and you invested that amount of money and you can't take it out for another 5 years or something like that, that's not considered part of the money supply. So the thing that's really curious to me about money is that money can be sort of created by the banks and the Federal Reserve. So this is like a totally hokey example of how one might create some money, but it's sort of the general idea. So let's suppose the Federal Reserve wants to increase the money supply in the country. They want to put out a little bit more money. So what they do is they write checks, $1,000 checks, to 1,000 different individuals. Okay, obviously they're not going to do that. They're going to give the money to the banks, and the banks are going to give the money out to the people. But let's just suppose it starts that way. They give out 1,000 checks for $1,000 individual. These 1,000 individuals all take their money, and they deposit it into a bank. Suppose they deposit it into Gutenberg Bank, for instance. It just started up. How much money is Gutenberg now holding? They're holding $1 million in their bank vault. But banks are allowed to lend more money than they actually have. Okay? So the bank is only required to hold a reserve of 10%. I'm not exactly sure what the reserve is now, but I think it's close to 10%. Let's suppose they're only forced to hold 10%. So they keep $100,000 of that cash that just got deposited in their bank, and they take the $900,000 and they lend it out to another company, let's suppose they lend it out to Gutenberg College. Okay, so Gutenberg Bank is lending $900,000 to Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College then goes, takes the $900,000 and they spend it on a new building. Okay, and where does all that money go? It goes to in the hands of the contractors and the suppliers and the wood builders and all these various other people. And all that money gets distributed around, and eventually it gets into various hands. And these people have all this money that they've gotten, the $900,000, and they put it all into a bank. All right? And just for simplicity, let's suppose they put it into all the same bank, and it's the McKinsey Study Center Bank. All right? So now we've got, McKinsey Study Center Bank has now got $900,000 of cash, right? And what are they going to do? They're going to keep $90,000 of that cash, and they're going to loan out $810,000, all right? And who are they going to loan it to? Who else? McKinsey Study Center. McKinsey Study Center then goes and buys a radio station and hires a bunch of employees, okay? So all that money that they spend, the employees and the radio station owner that used to own the radio station, they all have this money and they put it in the bank. They put it into the Art Project Bank. You can see how this is going to go. This is going to keep going on and on and on and on. So how much money is now in circulation in the country here? Well, all those people that put the first $1,000, they all own that money. That's their money. They have $1,000,000, right? But it's also the case that all those suppliers and contractors and various other people that got money from the building of the Gutenberg building, they all have money and they have put it in the bank. How much did they put in? $900,000. But it's also the case that the previous station owner and all the employees in the radio station, they all have a bunch of money and they have put $810,000 in the bank. And if you add up all the money that has been going around all this time, the total amount that you will actually get is 1 million times 10. Okay, because it was 10% was the amount of reserve that you had. And if you do all the math, which I would hate to do, but if you did it, you would come up with $10 million is now in circulation when you put in $1 million into circulation. And now we got $10 million because the banks are lending all that money out. All right. So that's the way you create money. In reality, it doesn't quite work that way. Not all the money gets put back into the banks and gets loaned out again, so it's not a perfect multiplier like that, but that's the basic idea, I think. Okay. So this can create a little bit of a problem, and it did create huge problems back, especially before 1933, okay, in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. Well, what happened is the bank, let's suppose Gutenberg Bank, is holding, remember, they're still holding $100,000. But how much do they owe their depositors? They owe their depositors $1 million, right? Well, Gutenberg presumably is going to be paying back $900,000, but Gutenberg doesn't have that cash on hand. So let's suppose a recession starts happening and 20 people are really in financial trouble, and so they have to get their money out. So they go to Gutenberg Bank and they say, we need our money. But a whole bunch of neighbors are starting to go, man, this recession is really bad. I'm worried that I'm going to lose my money. So I'm going to go and get my money out. So let's suppose 81 people out of fear go to the bank, and 20 people out of deep necessity go to the bank, and they all want their money out. That's 101 people, and they all want $1,000. So they want a total of $101,000 that they would like to pull out of that bank. Okay? Well, if they pull out $101,000, and Gutenberg Bank is holding how much? 100? Can't pay. It's called a run on the bank. Everybody wants to pull their money out, but the bank is only holding a 10% reserve. And if they're only holding that 10% reserve, they can't pay all their depositors at the same time. And the bank goes bankrupt, and all the depositors that were unable to pull their money out of the bank lose all their money. Okay, so the other 899 people lose out. They get nothing. Okay, that's a real problem. And because people were afraid of runs on banks, whenever there was the least sign of a scare that the bank was, if there was any kind of comment that this bank was not going to last, everybody would then stand in line. So the picture in the movie the other night of people standing in long lines to get their money out because they were afraid they were going to lose all their money. Okay. In 1933, the government introduced the Federal Deposit Insurance Company or something like that, which has been fairly successful in reducing the number of runs on banks because the government has said, well, if this bank goes under, we will guarantee your deposit up to a certain amount of money. I forget how much it is. Like, what is it, $100,000? Is that what it is? Something like that? $200? I don't know. I think it grew recently for some reason. $250 now? Okay, so the government will guarantee up to $250,000. So you can put up to $250,000 into a bank. If the bank fails, it doesn't matter. You'll get it back from the government. Who's paying for that? taxpayers are going to be paying for that. But it also reduces the number of runs on the bank. So I think that's a positive thing, possibly, if you're not a taxpayer. Okay, moving on. Okay, money supply and rates. So just briefly, the money supply has a big influence on a variety of rates, okay? There's three rates that I'm going to talk about. The third one's not really a rate. The interest rate, that's how much it costs to borrow money. There's the exchange rate, how we exchange money with foreign countries, okay? How much it costs to buy a euro or a pound or something like that. And then there's the aggregate price level. This is an abstraction, which is supposed to be a measure, some sort of weighted measure of all the various goods and services that are produced in the United States, okay? Let's suppose that, or let's suppose, for instance, that the money supply goes up. And if the money supply goes up, what will happen to these various rates? The first rate is the interest rate. And what's presumably going to happen in that case is the interest rate is going to go down because there's now a whole lot of money that has been put into the system. Banks have more money. They want to lend that money out. And they're going to have to lower the rate that they are going to lend money out in order to get enough people to borrow it, because at the existing rate, the number of people that are willing to borrow have already borrowed. But if you lower the rate a little bit, maybe you get a few more people to borrow it, and so you'll get a little bit more loan out. So if the money supply goes up, the interest rate goes down. The exchange rate becomes less favorable. In other words, the dollar is not worth as much compared to the pound or the euro as it was, because there's a glut of dollars. So there's more dollars, so the exchange rate, it becomes less favorable. And then the last one is the aggregate price level. This is the total price of goods. And this presumably will go up a little bit, because now that there's more money in circulation, everybody has a little bit more money in their pocket because the money supply has gone up a little bit. They have more money to pay for the same goods. We're not increasing the amount of goods. We're presumably keeping all this stuff fixed. And so if you have more money chasing the same amount of goods, then presumably the prices are going to go up, more demand in some sense. So according to those supply and demand pictures that we had up there, this is increasing the money supply is sort of going to jump the demand up, which will increase prices a little bit. I'm not going to talk about real and nominal. That's too complicated. I will make this one comment, is as the aggregate price level goes up, it can create inflation. Inflation is when the aggregate price level continues to go up over a long period of time, or it jumps up dramatically. Okay, in that situation, what will happen is banks who have an interest rate which has been going down are worried that there's inflation. If they're worried that there's inflation, then they are going to need to increase their interest rates to account for that inflation. Okay, because they don't want to lend out a bunch of money and then have the inflation go up. And then when those people that they lent it out to pay back the money back, the money that is being paid back actually is able to buy less goods and services than when they lent it out in the first place, because the inflation has gone so up so much. They may get more money, more actual money back, but the value of that money is down because of the increased inflation. And so banks are going to raise their interest rates eventually if they're worried about inflation or if they see inflation happening. And so it's conceivable that the money supply can not bring the interest rate down, but it can bring it up. But that's only if people are worried about inflation. So it's sort of it runs counter purposes. This is one of the big areas that the government uses to try and control the economy by flooding the system with more money and trying to change the interest rates to encourage businesses to borrow money to invest in producing things which will stimulate the economy. Okay, so next slide. So I'm done talking about money for the moment. Talk about expectations. Okay. I guess the biggest thing that I've learned about expectations is that they are sort of self-fulfilling. You get a positive feedback loop, for those of you who know anything about positive feedback loops. Okay. So let's see how that would work with, say, consumer expectations. Let's suppose, I've talked about this before, we have a fear of a recession. Okay. So if we have an expectation of a recession, then people will hoard their money. They will be less willing to spend. And if they are less willing to spend, then the demand for those goods will go down. And if the demand goes down, the companies that are producing those goods are not going to produce as many. And if they are not producing as many goods, then they are going to have to lay off some people. And if they're going to lay off some people, then there's going to be more unemployment. There's going to be less people that are going to be able to buy those goods. and it's going to create this spiral which is going to continue to go down. So the fear of a recession can actually drive the recession to be deeper than it was otherwise. Okay. Similarly, a hope of recovery can spur spending. People are saying, oh, look, things are looking good. I'm going to go out and buy my car now because I've been holding off, or I want to buy these things that I've been holding off on because I was so afraid. And that then creates a demand, which spurs companies to produce more, which then increases employment, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can spur that demand, that was sort of Keynes's view. If you could spur the demand, if you could get people spending, then you will resuscitate the economy if it's been in a recession. Okay. There are lots of other expectations that are important. Investor expectations, for instance. Investors may feel like there's some stock or some particular commodity or something that the prices are going to rise. Well, if they feel like the prices on this particular company, stock prices are going to rise, yeah, I'll buy some of that stock. Well, now if a whole bunch of people are buying stock, the demand for that stock has gone up. If the demand for the stock goes up, then you're going to have to pay a higher price, which is going to drive the price of the stock up. Self-fulfilling prophecy. So if a whole bunch of people all believe that the stock is going to go up, then guess what? They all invest, the stock goes up. There can be problems with that, which we will get to when we talk about crashes. Okay. Similarly, if they expect it to go down, prices can go down. Everybody's selling. Nobody has any that nobody wants to buy, and so the prices go way down. Inflation expectations. I talked about that briefly just a second ago. Depositor expectations. I talked about that as well. If the depositors all believe that the bank is going to fail, they all try and withdraw the money, the bank fails. Manufacturer expectations are similar. If that manufacturer expects high demand in the future, then they're going to produce more. And if they expect weak demand, then they are going to scale back. Okay? So all these expectations are really, really significant, it seems to me, in the way that the economy works. And the psychology of the people and the psychology of the people who are buying and selling and producing and all that other kind of stuff is going to have a big impact on how that works. So let's see an example of that in action. Let's talk about oil, what happened with oil in 2008. In 1976, oil was bought with large-term contracts, okay, from a few major producers. However, smaller oil companies started coming on the scene, and they would undersell these large contracts and large producers, and so the price would get cheaper. Well, now the market was a lot more responsive, okay? But if there was an oil glut or if there was a lack of supply or something like that, then the prices would sort of fluctuate a lot. Well, it's really hard to run a business if, for instance, an airplane business or something else, if the price of oil is going way up and down all the time. So people figured out, oh, well, what we're going to do is we're going to create a future, okay? We're going to create this new financial instrument, I'll call it, where Shell Oil and Southwest Airlines are going to come into this agreement. And Southwest says, look, in 1 year, I'm going to need 1 million barrels of oil, okay, or gallons of gas or whatever. And I want you to deliver it to me in 1 year. And they go, okay, well, what price? They agree on some price, okay? And they sign a contract, and that's guaranteed. So if the price goes up, Southwest was the winner. If the price goes down, Shell is the winner because they're going to get more money than it's actually worth at that time. But it's sort of a way of hedging your bets. At least both of you can agree at this time. Hopefully in the future things will be stable, but we're going to guess this is where it's going to be. So now Southwest can plan their business. They know exactly how much their oil is going to be, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the problem with this was that not only Southwest Airlines can buy these futures, investors can buy futures. The investor says, I think the oil market is going to go up, okay? So they'll make this agreement that they're going to buy 1 million barrels of oil in a few years or a year from now. And they think the price is going to go up, so they create this contract with Shell Oil. And then what do? They go around and they say, hey, you guys, look, the oil's going to go up. Do you want to buy my future? You can make a lot of money. And if everybody thinks that oil is going to go up, then all of a sudden people start buying these futures. And then if they think the price is going to go down, they want to sell it. And if the price is going to go up, they all buy them. So apparently, from what I read, it's all based on what they expect the price of oil is going to do. Apparently, 90% of futures trading was done by speculators and not by companies that actually are going to buy the oil. So what happened in 2008 was there was this false sense of the direction that the oil price was going to go. Okay? It was created by a variety of media presentations. Everybody was worried that China was going to be buying all this oil and all these other sorts of things like that, and that there was going to be a shortage of oil or something like that, and so the investors all thought the price of oil was going to go up. So the speculators were buying futures, and as the more they bought, the higher the price went of these futures, and everything started to go up. The price of oil was going up. There were investment firms that were predicting $200 a barrel oil prices and stuff. People were just going crazy about this. Of course, some of these people that were releasing this information were undisclosed sources, presumably, perhaps maybe invested heavily in the oil market, hard to say. But the reality of the situation is painted perhaps by some of the quotes that I have at the bottom. One of the things I think is very important to realize is that the growth in the world oil consumption is not that strong. That was written in May 2004. And then the U.S. Senate staff report wrote, there is a substantial evidence that the large amount of speculation in the current market has significantly increased oil prices. Well, that was true. So eventually people realized that their expectations for the price of the oil going up were not going to be realized. When they realized that, they said, "Ooh, my future's not really going to be all that good after all." So people started selling. And the more they started selling, the more people got panicked, and they tried to sell more and sell more and sell more. So the price of oil went way down. So it was sort of the expectations driven by perhaps misinformation, perhaps not, that drove the oil prices up, I think, in 2008. That's my take on that situation. Okay, we'll move to the next one. Crashes. All right, as far as I can tell, most all the crashes that I've looked into, I've looked in a few of them, all have some of the same heuristics. And I just say right now, there may be a crash you can come up with, I'm sure there is, that don't have all these characteristics. So this is just general characteristics that it seems like most crashes seem to have. Okay. Usually there's something that spurs them, some change in the economy. It could be a combination of different changes. There could be a new financial instrument, futures, hedge funds. I would say the introduction of the stock market in the 1920s was kind of new. Prior to that, it was not something that the people in general were concerned about or thinking about or investing in. In fact, it was thought of as sort of dirty and immoral, perhaps, but it just was not something that a gentleman would do, would be to invest in the New York Stock Exchange. That was, and when they did invest, they had to go through sort of secret avenues with little brokers to put their money in so that nobody else would know what they were doing. Anyway, so there's something new, maybe a new market in a foreign country, a new regulatory environment. Like, for instance, you may have a regulatory environment that encourages home sales at lower interest rates to encourage people to buy. You might have a new demand from a technology like the dot-com boom or some new source of funds, like an increase in the money supply. In the 1920s, there was one period of time when the Fed was trying to keep the rates low by increasing the money supply, and the banks were all taking the money that the Fed was feeding to them, and were they investing it in businesses in order to spur production or anything like that? No. A lot of what the banks were doing was lending to investors who then took that money and then invested it in the stock market. So a lot of new cash that was available was being put into a stock market at that time. Okay. So investors then see an opportunity and start investing. Investors could be people investing on the stock market. They could be people who are buying houses. They could be people who, any kind of investor like that. And the investment creates some excitement, rising values. You get this bandwagon mentality. Usually there's some sort of unwillingness to accept the fact that this whole thing could come down crashing. For instance, AIG, who lost a ton of money and cost us, I don't know how many billion dollars, they were rated as a triple A stock or something like that. This was the best of the best. These guys are safe, but they weren't. But so people were somehow not willing to look at the problems that are going on. Usually there's some sort of supply that follows. The supply follows the lead of these investors. Like, for instance, if everybody starts buying homes now and there's this feeling that home prices are going up and a lot of people are buying homes and stuff like that, well, what's going to happen? People are going to build more homes, right? So all of a sudden you're going to start building all these homes, and some people are buying the homes for themselves, some people are buying the homes to invest so that they can sell them in the future, some people are buying homes so they can improve them and flip them or something like that. So people are going to start producing more. Eventually, reality bites back. They realize that this creation of a bubble is not sustainable. There aren't really that many people that want all these new homes, okay? There was a story in the third edition or the third part of the movie that we saw where they talk about what happened in Malaysia. Malaysia opened their markets. All these investors flooded in. There was all this new money. Things were going great. Malaysia decided, we're going to build a whole new city between the main city in Malaysia and the airport. Kuala Lumpur, possibly? I don't remember. Anyway, so they built this whole new city right between the main one and the airport. And guess what? Nobody moved in because there was nobody that wanted all that stuff. So as soon as everybody realized that nobody was going to move in, all the investors go, I'm getting out of here. I'm pulling my money. And there was a huge crash, which had huge, significant impact on Southeast Asia and Korea and a variety of different countries over in that area. It was a huge crash, okay? So everybody wants to sell. Manufacturers stop producing. Nobody wants to buy. Values plummet, and you get the big crash. Okay, some of the reasons why there's a crash, I call it margin buying and risk, okay? In the 1920s, investors would borrow money from the bank. But they didn't have to have a lot of collateral to buy stock. They could have 10% collateral. Like when we buy a house, usually everybody knows that you have to put down a down payment. You have to have some cash that you could conceivably lose if the house price goes down or if you can't pay for the house. You have to put up some collateral. The lower that collateral is, the more risky that investment is. Okay, and that amount of collateral is often referred to as margin. Okay. So somebody who's investing in the stock market, for instance, they have in their pocket real cash of $1,000. They can use that collateral to borrow $9,000 and invest $10,000 in the stock market, okay? Well, this is kind of a deal. It can be a real deal, okay? Let's suppose you have, my example was you started with $100 and you buy $1,000 worth of stock. You borrowed $900. All right, let's suppose the stock price goes up 1%. Then you've made $10. What's your return on your actual cash that you had? That's a 10% return because you only really started with $100 and now you've made $10. Wow, that's pretty nice. You just made a 10% return on that thing. In fact, let's suppose the stock goes up only 12%. That's a real good return. That's 120% return on your cash. The problem is that if the stock price goes down, you're also having real huge losses on your money as well. Okay? So if the stock price goes down more than 10%, all of the money that you put in collateral is gone. And the money that the bank put out, they've also lost some money because you can't pay back the bank because your stock is not worth the amount of money that you just borrowed. If your stock is worth less than $900, you can't pay back the bank. Who's left holding the bag? Well, you lost all your collateral, which was not very much, but the banks can lose a lot in those situations. And when the stock market went down, that had a huge impact on the banks. It caused runs on the bank, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So it seems to me that this risk, the fact that you can people really like to be able to earn a lot of money in a very short period of time. And so even though it's very risky, some people will engage in this kind of behavior in hopes that they can make a lot of money. But it's not a particularly responsible way of going about that because you can lose a lot as well, it seems to me. All right. Another thing that causes crashes is some sort of lack of regulation on new financial instruments or poor regulation. So as far as I can tell, a lot of times new things come on the scene that the government just doesn't keep up with. The hedge funds were created, the stock market in the 1930s, a variety of different things happen, and it's like the government is going, oh, look, there's a hedge fund, or what do we do about that? I don't know. Do we need to have regulations? Well, probably. What should they be? I'm not exactly sure what they should be. And it's because it's so new, and people are using those and all kinds of misbehavior, possibly, and taking advantage of people can happen in those situations. And it's only after the fact, possibly, that the government is going to step in and say, oh, we really do need some rules here. But sometimes the government can create the problem by creating regulations like in the housing market. We're probably all familiar with that, where they encouraged banks to lend at lower interest rates and more risky loans and all that sort of thing like that. So those sorts of things can also cause crashes. Expectations and fear, like I said before, those expectations can create a run-up and also a crash at the same time. And then last and very importantly, in order to have a bubble, in order to have a crash, in order to have things run up, somebody's got to have some cash to invest. And where are you going to get all that cash? All right. Usually it comes from an increase in the money supply, or it could come from an increase in personal savings. Like, for instance, I suspect that the introduction of the individual retirement account, the IRA, caused a lot of people to be investing their pensions and their retirements, stocks and mutual funds and various other things like that, which created a huge amount of money that was going into those sorts of things. And now all these people who were investors and were in control of all these mutual funds had a lot of cash on hand that they wanted to invest, which is one of the sources, perhaps, of a crash, depending on how that money is used. Okay, that's all I was going to say on that. Government intervention, go on. So let's talk a little bit about some of the tools that the government has to try and control the economy. The first is money supply. Increasing and decreasing the money supply can affect the interest rates and presumably the incentive to invest. Okay, it's a limited tool. If you bring the interest rate down, as it is now, I think the interest rate is like the prime rate or whatever you call it is near zero, or the discount rate is right near zero, is that's where it's hovering around. You can't go lower than that. And so it's really cheap to get money, presumably. But if companies don't think that there's anybody that's going to buy their goods, they're not going to borrow a whole bunch of money to build a new factory to make more goods that nobody's going to buy. So just on its own, the money supply can't fix everything. So one of the other things that people sometimes will use is fiscal policy, spending and tax cuts. Try and put some cash in the hands of the people, cash in the hands of the businesses by spending a lot of money. That's deficit spending. You're spending more than you're taking in on taxes in the hope that if everybody has a whole bunch of money, then everybody's going to spend a whole lot of money and that's going to stimulate the economy. Of course, that doesn't always work as planned. I'm not exactly sure about this, but my sense was that there was a period of time not that long ago, I don't know how many years, two years ago, where Bush had these tax cuts. And everybody got like $600 or $1,200. Did everybody get like a check in the mail or something like that? And my sense was that that money was not spent and stimulate the economy as well as they had hoped. And the reason why is because there was fear of a recession. And so when people got that cash, rather than going out and spending it, they all saved it, or they paid off their debt, or did something like that. So basically, the money did not go out and stimulate the economy. But sort of the general idea is that if you spend a lot of money, people will be increase the demand. If you increase the demand, then presumably the businesses will see the increase in demand and raise production and hire more people. If they hire more people, the unemployment will go down, those sorts of things like that. Regulation can have a huge impact. Remember the 10% margin that was required for those stock market purchases? If you change that regulation, you can change the way people invest. I think after the 1930s, that margin went way up. I think I read 50%, but I'm not sure. Somebody maybe who's more knowledgeable would be able to tell me on that. Also, you can try other kind of regulations, would be price fixing or lending regulations, trying to curb abuses, those sorts of things. And some of those regulations are really necessary and valuable, it seems to me, but they have to be done wisely. Then you can try public relations announcements. One of the presidents said, oh, we should spend more money, encouraged everybody to spend money to stimulate the economy. That kind of falls flat, I suspect, but you can try that through various media outlets to, I don't know exactly if this is true, but my sense is that sometimes the media will try and boost the economy by saying how good things are and not talking about all the things that are bad. And they'll talk about how good things are. And sometimes they'll only talk about how bad things are and not talk about how good things are. I don't know. It's kind of crazy. I don't know if I understand all that stuff. Other tool that the government can use is by actually owning sectors of the economy, the Amtrak or post office or something like that. And by increasing or decreasing the efficiency, you can stimulate the economy. And then lastly, I haven't talked much about this, but it's a really important thing, is international negotiations and regulations on trade. I'm not going to spend very much time on that, but I think it's an important aspect on how you can increase or improve your economy. Okay, this is the last one, recessions and depressions. So I know we've talked about this probably ad nauseum, but just sort of to summarize, using some of the ideas that I've talked about here, the classical theory, as far as I understand, pre-Keynesian, was that the free market through natural economic forces will fluctuate around an equilibrium. If there's a recession, unemployment will cause its wage to drop. If there's a large pool of labor, you can charge less for wages. If you charge less for wages, you can produce something less expensively. And so since you can produce something less expensively, the supply curve will shift and things will get a little bit cheaper and you can produce more and things will jumpstart that way. Also, presumably if there's a recession, people are worried about the recession, so they tend to save more. The rich people will save more. There's more money in the banks. If there's more money in the banks, then the interest rates will go down in the same way that if the Fed puts a whole bunch of money in the banks, the interest rates will go down. And if the interest rates will go down, that will presumably spur the businesses to expand. That was the classical theory. But of course, there were presumably some problems with that. And that was what Keynes was trying to come up with, some way of bringing us out of a recession in those situations by tinkering with these things, tinkering with taxation, tinkering with the interest rates to spur and stimulate the economy, those sorts of things. Okay, Keynes would say there's no automatic adjustment towards equilibrium. If the unemployment happens and low wages lowers demand so that even if it is cheaper to sell the products, nobody's buying them because nobody has any money. So there's no way of automatically pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and getting the economy going again. Okay. So the Keynesian solution is to, during recession, stimulate demand by tax cuts, I think, put money in the hands of the people, deficit spending by spending on projects and getting a lot of money out there so that people have more cash so that they can increase demand. So let's see. And then alternatively, during growth periods, you want to raise taxes to sort of cool things down so it doesn't get going too high or too fast, and decrease spending and raise rates. So monetary policy versus spending. In a recession, lowering rates has a minor effect, and increased production is based on long-term expectations. So there are limits to these kinds of things that the government can do. Just because the Fed has lowered the interest rate practically to zero isn't necessarily going to stimulate the economy instantaneously. Some problems that can happen from these kinds of use of government tools is that government fixes can become permanent stifling government programs, and stagflation was caused by using these sorts of tools, caused an excessive money supply and monetary policy, and that created a lot of inflation. And there's lots of different situations where governments have tried to print themselves out of problems by printing more money, and what it created was huge inflation. So these things have to be used carefully and with wisdom, and I think a lot of times the politics kind of can get in the way to me to make it to where using these tools well is not done. So those are some of the problems. Okay, so that's all I have to say. Hopefully there was something useful that you learned from there.